Good morning. So today I am going to do exam review. So that's going to consist of me talking about things you ask me to talk about. If you don't ask me to talk about something, I just won't talk about it. I'll assume that you would rather I spend time on other things. So what would people like me to talk about? Check. Anyone? Okay, cache blocking. Okay, other things. Yes. Pipelining. And I would note that if you don't want something that I feel will be very generic and probably not answer your actual questions, you should ask something more specific. Yes.
How specific are questions about HCL?
Okay. Other things? Yes.
Quiz 10, questions 6 through 9.
Which is about?
Spatial and temporal locality. Which is in, like, C code.
Yep.
Could you, like, really briefly go over the, like, specific architecture of an out-of-order processor?
So, the sort of high-level block diagram? Questions 1 and 4, which are multi-level page tables and TLBs, respectively. Yeah. I should make sure, I suppose, that I didn't miskey that quiz, but it'll get there.
There's no correct answer to number 1.
Oh, so that's definitely not keyed correctly then. How did that happen? The first answer should be correct for number 1. And fix that. So other things, yes. Okay. Yes. Sorry, which quiz? Number 2, which is multi-level page tables.
Yeah, go over for quiz 14, questions 2, 3, and 4.
Which is our about...
same thing, multi-level page tables. Or like page table size, I think.
Okay.
And then
Yeah, I hope they aren't multi-level page tables because of what we covered.
Could you give an example of putting, carrying a cache, tag and index and so on?
So cache, tag, index splitting?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Quiz 6, question 5, which is about throughput.
Okay. So... throughput in a pipeline processor?
Yeah.
Okay.
The difference between properties of an instruction set architecture and macro
architecture. Okay. Okay. So let's organize these. So we have, I guess I'll probably do these first because I've covered them. Otherwise, oh, probably should do exam format stuff first. That So, I guess, yes. Is that TLBs?
Yes.
Okay. Exceptions, okay.
This is a general question, but will content be like evenly spread throughout the semester or will there be
exams? So let's go exam format generally then, or other thing, topics, or... Okay, so, yeah.
Will you upload this to the course website?
Will this appear on the course website? Yes, just like it's, well, there's going to be a lecture recording, and I will also upload the text file I'm editing right now. Okay, so exam format generally. So it will be sort of multiple choice and short answer questions similar to the quizzes. So I will generally avoid questions... Would questions that, you know, I would expect you to use, like, you to use a compiler or look things up, etc. Because it's not. Take a move. Yes?
Will we have any way to, like, quickly convert from, like, binary to hex and back?
Question is, will you have, so no calculators, and yes, you should be able to convert from binary... From binary to hexadecimal and vice versa. Maybe we should talk about how to do that. I thought we taught this in 2150, but I guess that's not true. Because, you know, it's not really very nice to ask questions about how virtual memory and caches work without, and like have to write everything out in binary. It's also a skill that might come in useful at some point. It's not. And I don't want calculators, not because I want you to learn that skill, but because it's just way too hard to police you not having, like, a find the cache tag program on your calculator. Or something like that. Yeah. Multiple choice and short answer. And multiple choice includes select all that apply, yes. So it's roughly evenly covering the semester we cover a lot of things in the semester, you know, but some topics are more represented. Especially if I feel like they aren't things we can cover in assignments very well. So, because the exam gives me a chance to ask questions that I can't ask on assignments, and some topics are more represented just because it's hard to write it. Because it's, you know, of what exam questions I happen to write and they only have so much space. I'm going to have to, since I didn't like write a true false question about every single topic, like we're going to have some, if I write a long question about something, that's going to be like 5-8% of the exam and probably didn't spend 5-8% of the class covering it. So that just happens. We will supply a reference sheet that's linked off the schedule, which I should bring up and show. Right, actually, I guess it probably would be easier for me to. Well, no, I guess I don't have the canonical version. So, which has this on the first page and this on the back. So you don't need to memorize that. And yes, it's a, I will give the whole 3 hours. I hope it doesn't take that long because, it's sort of, my estimate is that it's sort of equivalent to like 43-ish exam or quiz questions, 40 to 43, which, but we don't ask questions where you have to look things up, but, yeah. Yeah.
Is there any curving of any kind that is possible?
Question is how this is figured into the final grade. I will decide whether I need to do something other than make a 70 a C minus at the end of the semester, and that will depend on whether the final worked out the way I expected, which I can only kind of guess. My guess is that I won't need have feel like that makes sense to do. To make it higher, that is. I'll probably just leave it there. If I do it, it's not curving, because I'm not going to like try to fit the class grades to a bell curve and say, oh, the median should be a B minus, which is what curving traditionally means. It's going to be, oh gosh, I'm giving a B to someone who did great on all the assignments and just missed these things on the exam that I think are hard. I probably shouldn't be doing that. That's what I'm going to be looking for. Okay, and specificness of HTL questions. Generally, we're not going to ask about HTL syntax. Syntax, and not going to have you memorize CL built-in components. If you need to know them, we will tell you about them. If syntax matters, like we won't ask like, what's the syntax for this? Like we could like show you like code with a mux and expect you to recognize that, but we're not going to like say, oh, is this the correct syntax for a mux or not, or something like that. Okay, so then let's get to our bunch of questions about quiz 15. Let's see. And I guess probably, okay, so I will probably do, so question 1 and 2, okay, are not multi-level page table questions. They are allocate on demand questions. So for allocating on demand, the allocation occurs when a page fault happens. So to set up allocate on demand, the OS needs to make sure a page fault will happen. And this is done, this implies that we configure a memory region as invalid. As invalid in the page table. The page table entries and page table entries are always looked up by virtual address. And invalid page table entries, there's a physical address field, but it's not used. So it has to be corresponding to a virtual address, because there's no notion of an invalid page table entry having a physical address. Does that answer those questions on 1 and 2? Yeah. So the answer for the first one is A, yes. And that will be corrected probably in a few minutes or after this lecture if that doesn't happen. Okay. So question 3, which is actually about multi-level page tables. And I believe question 3 and 4 are both about multi-level. Question 3 and 4 are both about multi-level page tables. Okay, so we're asked to... We have the address... This address is our virtual address, and we are told... Oh, sorry, this is our page table base pointer. So, this, sorry, that's not a virtual. It's a... We have a different virtual address. And we have this virtual address. And we say that... And we know that the first level PTE is valid... and physical page number 1111, and the second level PTE is valid and physical page number 0x4321. And we are told that we have 892 byte pages, which is 2 to the 13 bytes pages, which implies 13 bits of page offset, and that we have 1,024 entries per table, which means that we have 2 to the 10 entries per table, which means we have 10-bit page virtual page number parts. So, the first question 3 is address... So physical address of the first level PTE. So the address we use to find that it's valid and has physical page number 1111. And this is going to be our page table base register plus the first part of the VPN times the PTE size. We are told in the question that the PTE size is 8. And the first part of the VPN, so this is PTR, the first part of the VPN is our virtual address shifted over 10 to remove, shifted over 13 to remove the page offset, and then shifted over 10 more to remove the second part of the VPN. And that all times 8 are PTE size. And that's how you can get that. So, and then question 4 is what is the final address? So this is 0x4321, shifted over 13 to move it. So this is our 4321, our final physical page number. Shifted over 13 to move it where, you know, into where the PPN goes in address, plus the 7-8, and with to extract the page offset from the original VPN. And 0x1FFF is 13 ones. Yes.
The question is really, why could you take the physical page number that you gave us and shift it left 13?
So the question is, why couldn't I take the physical page number I gave you? You mean this one?
Yes.
So this physical page number is the value we find at this address. Because this is the... So this first level PTE is at stored at... 0x444 something. And the second level PTE is stored at 0x111 something. So what you'd be finding
would be something related to where the second level page table entry is stored, not. And we want to find this address where the first level page table entry is stored, where that 1111 is stored. Does that answer your question? So in the question, do we use this RX-111 at all? In the questions we gave, you don't. But if we asked you, for example, what the address we used to look up the second level page table entry to find 4321, then you would use it. Yes?
Is there any way to tell like where the valid or executable bits or anything like that is going to be, or is that just always given?
Question, is there any way to tell where the valid or executable bits are? No, you have to be told. Other questions? Yes.
So did you find that it seems like the first two parts of the first part and the second part of the virtual page number are not the same size?
So the question is, how is it the case that you were given this address and it actually works because you added up all the sizes and you said 13 plus 10 plus 10 is 33? I just didn't write the first zero. Because I don't have to write all the zeros when I write numbers. Yes?
Are there any tricks to doing bit shifts in multiple regions quickly if we don't have access to a calculator or a converter or anything?
Okay, so I guess I should talk about binary to hex, hex to binary stuff. So converting binary to hex and hex to binary, which is generally how I would do this, is every 4 bits is 1 hex digit. So just, take groups of 4 bits from the least significant side, so you don't have things misaligned when you get to the end. Side, find the hex digit for it. And hex to binary is, every hex digit is 4 bits, so convert, probably starting with the least significant side, so you don't side each hex digit to binary, and note that if you want, e.g., bits 13 through 20, then you can start bits 13 through 20, then we have 4, so this is 4 is bits 0 through 3, or I guess I should do, let's say bits 12 through 13 through 20, yeah, so 0 through 3, and this is bits 4 through 7, and this is bits 8 through 11, so you can tell not to start. Then you can skip entire hex digits. So you should look for ways of skipping entire hex digits, and this comes up very frequently when we're asking for cache tags or virtual page numbers. So try to skip whole hex digits, e.g., 4 bits 13 through 20. You only need to look at 0x, the one above. And there's leading zeros. Zeros, but. Okay, so that's sort of that, and that's why I don't think it's unreasonable to give you a hex number and ask you to find, bit 13 of it. And this is 13 through 20 zero based. So it'd obviously be off by one if it was one-based, which depends on how you're getting the index. Okay, so then back to our quiz questions. So question 5 and 6. So is asking, is saying that we is asking, is saying that we read a first level PTE at index 0 of a table. So this is VPN part 1 is 0. We read a second level PTE at index 1-4 of a table. So of a so VPN part 2 is 0x14. And we have a 32 entry two-way set associative TLB. And this means that our TLB has 4 index bits because it has 16 equals 32 divided by 2 sets. And something we can note is that given this information, we can reconstruct the virtual page number. And the virtual page number is 0x14. And this virtual page number 0x14, we can write out in binary as 0. This part is our TLB index, and everything else is our TLB tag. Because that's what it includes. Yes?
So if he wrote the 5 and 6 not in, like, the answer not in text, but like we got it's 1 for the tag and 4 for the
answer, will we get like... Yes. So the question is, if you wrote the answer in binary, should we get credit? Yes. So someone's going to have to go through that question, and yeah, Probably I'm going to have to do some of the grading for that because my TAs have suddenly gotten busy. I don't know why that happens. But yeah, we'll go through and give credit for it because I didn't specify the format. Okay. But I wrote, yeah, my answer key is in hexadecimal, which is the key.
I was
going to
say, if you did it in decimal, like if you had 4 and 1, would that also count?
Yeah, that should count, but we have to go through and like make sure we give actual credit for that. But that's... That's just that I didn't account for the answer formats, and I forgot to specify the answer formats, so obviously I'm not going to get credit for that. That's how you do the question, and there's a bunch of information in the question that you don't need, and part of it is realizing, oh, the TLB only cares about the virtual page number, we don't need the physical page number is like not part of the lookup, and so on. So questions about... Other questions? Yes. How did I get 14? Because our second part of our TLB was 1-4, because that's what the index we looked up in the second level table. So let's keep going here. So back to beginning of the semester stuff. So static linking. So static linking, so I'm not sure whether the person asking this was asking for this opposed dynamic linking, but static linking means that we end up with an executable we can copy into memory and jump to. So that's our goal. And to do this, work, we need to make it so jump, call, etc. instructions have the address, have addresses or offsets filled in correctly. So that's right. So for example, if we have jump foo, or I guess if we have call foo, e.g., so the linker needs to know where all things like call foo, or move, the sort of global string point variable to somewhere. So uses of a what should end up being a hard coded address offsets. So it can make these have the correct values in the machine code, even though the assembler doesn't know what these values are. And the assembler doesn't know what these values are because the assembler doesn't know where anything's going to end up in memory, because it doesn't know, like, you know, which version of main or printf are you going to use yet. Because we're only assembling one of those files. Yes? So I guess versus dynamic linking, you know, same high level idea, but we do part of the address fix up when we load the program, which means so we can, you know, choose what files we load, what, I guess, libraries, etc., we load at, you know, program start time. Yes?
So, in terms of what you said, like call foo or the global string variable data, like in terms of the actual like address and call foo as like an address executable, and I guess the string address, or there's like just the actual string as well, where would that be in each of the
So the question is, where did the address appear? So in the executable file, the address is in the instruction. So in the, I guess, the object file, so what do we have in the object file? So in the object file, we can't have final, addresses, can't know addresses of anything yet, and won't know most offsets. So what we need to do is, so what we will have is, we will have symbol tables are, if we have foo colon in our assembly, we need to remember the location of foo. So foo colon could be marking a function, marking a jump, or so on. We'll need to remember that, so we'll have a symbol table entry for it. And relocations are, if we use foo other than defining it, we need to tell the linker about this. So we will have a relocation table entry for it. And, you know, something that helps me remember it is the linker doesn't ever actually read, doesn't understand machine code. It just does what the relocations say. So the linker doesn't know it's a call instruction. All it knows is there's a relocation that says foo goes here. And the symbol table entry is, hey linker, foo is in this location in the data, machine code or data. Yes?
When you say use foo, what would that include?
So using foo, so, you know, e.g., so call foo. Any instruction where we use the name foo, other than defining it. Yeah. Location. So for the symbol table entry, you mean?
Yes.
Location, where it is in the machine code or data that's in the object file. Does that answer your question? Okay.
So for like the literal ASCII string, that is the variable, that would be like, global variable string, and then, or I guess it would be the symbol table would have global variable string, and then the literal, like, ASCII value.
So for, you're saying, for example of a global string variable, if we have it declared, like, so if we have string variable value, you're asking where, are you asking where the text global string variable appears, or where this initial value appears?
I guess, how does it get replaced in the,
so the EXE file? So the initial value is going to be part of the data in the .o and exe, and this is going to identify a symbol table entry and relocation table entries that refer to this. And the relocation table entry is not for that line, but for other lines that use it. Okay. Yes. Okay, so question is that .global and .local. So we didn't like go over this in much detail. So .global, so the assembler directive .global is this global foo is foo can be used elsewhere, can be used from other files. The assembler might not put the name foo in the symbol table as is. Or I guess the assembler name foo in the symbol table without this. It will still have a symbol table entry for it, so it can be used locally in the file, but it won't put the name in a way that, I guess, symbol table without this in a way that other files can use. It will put something in the symbol table for it, or somehow identify its location, but it won't actually have the information set up so other files can use it. Yeah.
So I'm a little still confused about symbol versus relocation, because it seems like the relocation says, like, oh, foo is here in the machine code, but that's what the symbol table is.
So the symbol table is foo is here in the machine code. The relocation table, the symbol table is foo is, should, if you use foo, it should point here. It's where the foo colon was. And the relocation table is, please insert the address of foo here. Make a pointer here.
So foo colon is like where it's defined.
Yeah. Where it's defined, yeah. So symbol tables are, so relocation tables are insert pointer here. Pointer at location X. Okay, so ISA versus microarchitecture. So ISA, or instruction set architecture, is the interface supplied to software. This includes like the operating system, assemblers, operating system, assemblers, etc. And and generally not including, performance issues. Like, so how fast things are, not an ISA issue. It's just, what does this instruction compute? What type of errors can it have, and so on. How big a value does it use, and all that stuff. But not performance stuff, not how fast is it. That's not part of the ISA. So the microarchitecture is the actual sort of hardware implementation. So this generally says like how, this includes how fast are instructions, what can be done in parallel. So an example of a microarchitecture thing is whether we have a pipeline or out of order or single cycle processor. That's a microarchitecture decision. All of those can implement the same instruction set architecture. You could have a processor which does any of those three designs, and you'd write the same assembly code, use the same assemblers, same OS, and all you notice is the performance is different. So, can you run parallel? So, how registers are stored. So, like, we learned a microarchitectural decision was that sometimes we have, like, this giant physical register file that we can't see. And sometimes we don't, but that doesn't affect the assembly we write, doesn't affect the OS we write. So, that's a microarchitecture decision. Okay, so then on pipelining, so sort of our high-level idea for pipelining is that we divide our instructions into pieces. Instruction one does, piece K, while instruction two does piece K minus one, while instruction three does piece K minus three, etc. And sort of how many pieces is the number of pipeline stages. We chose four, we chose five, so our pipe homework two was five stages, but we could have done a different number of stages. Same amount of level eight applies. And we needed to do extra work for hazards, which are cases where instructions depended on each other, so that we had to do work besides dividing the instruction into stages and passing instructions from one stage to the next. Yes. Question is exam format. Are the questions the order we learn the material? Not necessary. No. So because the exam rooms are rather, we're using most of the space. I intend to have a couple variants of the exams with the question order randomized to not tempt people to look at their neighbor and see what multiple choice things are answered, because it probably won't help you if the questions are randomized. Then we have quiz 6, question 5. Okay, which is this question. So we're saying that we have a pipeline processor that has 1,000 instructions a microsecond. That has five stages. So what this means is that, so assuming no hazard handling, hazard stalling, related stalls, that we have a cycle time of, one cycle a microsecond. Or, sorry, 1,000 cycles a microsecond. And we're asking, what's the performance going to be if we turn this into a single cycle processor? So, sort of our best case is that, the pipeline processor stages all take the same amount of time. So we'd get 1,000 divided by 5 equals 200 instructions a microsecond. So that's sort of sort of the sort of best possible pipeline processor case. So this is the best possible pipeline processor design. That's what we expect. Because can't possibly have done a better job of making a pipeline processor than that. Then we make a pipeline processor, we have absolutely no overhead. And the worst possible pipeline processor case is that we're really doing all the work in one stage. The way our pipeline processor works is that we essentially have all the work in like the first stage and everything else is just fluff. In that case, we'd get 100 cycle a microsecond. And our assumption is that we're somewhere in between. Yeah, should be in between this best and worst case, best worst pipeline processor design. Is that questions on that? Yes. So question is, this probably is, do you have free, oh, what, stalling and forwarding? So just about combining them?
Yes.
So stalling is, so forwarding is we have a value, so we need a value in stage K, and that hasn't been written yet, but the instruction that's supposed to write it is now in stage K plus, X, and has computed it. And in this case, what we do, so solution, take the value from stage K plus X, even though it hasn't been written. Even though it hasn't been written yet. So sometimes we need a value that hasn't been written yet and hasn't been computed yet. So in this case, we need to stall so it's been computed. And usually, after we do that, stall that much, it still hasn't been written. So we use forwarding to resolve the hasn't been written problem. Does that answer your question? Okay, so yes. Right after write back, we have a buff in the pipeline processor.
Yeah, there's like something right after write back where the values go, so that
you can
like.
Oh, so in an out of order processor, we had something that kind of looked like that, and we had something called a write buffer and a cache. But I don't think we had anything analogous in a pipeline processor. Okay, so cache tag, index splitting. Okay, so. The general rule is we want to know to find the tag, first find everything else. It probably should be your last step because tag is the leftover. It's always the leftover. So if you're finding the tag first, you're probably not doing things right or we're giving you a weird set of information. To find the index, count the number of sets. So the number of sets and how depends on the information. So, e.g., if we tell you cache size plus block size plus number of ways is enough to do it. So cache size divided by block size divided by number of ways, and sort of the way I remember this is, you know, is to think about our, think about rows in our cache diagram. So we think we, so the sets are our rows, we have, you know, way 0, 1, and this is a block. Right, this is sort of our notional cache diagram, and the cache size is the number of bytes, bytes in blocks, so the divided by the block size gives us the number of blocks total, divided by the number of ways gives us the number of rows, and like you can kind of work that out using the sort of picture of what a cache looks like, and that's sort of how I would recommend reasoning about things. You can also memorize the formulas in the textbook, but that's not something I recommend because, you know, that's, you should be able to derive these from sort of the notion of how the cache works, and often people like mix things up in those formulas and, you know, mix up like the number of sets and the number of set index bits, and that's going to be very different if you do that. And it's easy to check your answers with the sort of picture notion. Yes?
I know that you adjusted the formula sheet previously. Would it be possible if you added like the, that one slide that had like
big... Question, am I going to put, can I put the cache formulas on the reference sheet? I'm deliberately not doing that because you should be able to derive them from the operational picture of how the cache works. Which it, yeah. So if a question, if I say a cache has an entry, number of entries, that's the number of blocks, yes. I should avoid using the term entries for non-TLB caches. So I use the term entry for TLBs because it's a page table entry. It's being stored. And I guess I should mention for the tag, everything else, else equals the index plus the offset size. I guess the other thing to note is that, you know, if you know, if you have an address and know the index and offset are at the end, you can take the end of the, at the sort of, I guess, the least significant part, take the least significant part off, out, away, out, and get the tag. The tag, you might not find out the tag size in the process, which size, you don't need it. Right, if you can take out the stuff that's not the tag, you don't need to know how many leading zeros there are on the tag. Like, obviously, if we're building a cache, we're going to know that because we're going to have to, like, make a memory that can hold that the tag, but if you're just like asked what's the tag for this address, you don't actually need to like compute the number of tag bits. Okay, then write policies for caches. So on a cache, so if we're storing a value in a cache, if we've already decided we're storing a value in the cache, we have to decide how to handle writes to that value. And we, no matter what, no matter our policy, we must update the copy in the cache. So if we decide we're storing the value, we better update the copy in the cache, or else we're going to be really confused later on when we read back the wrong value. So we have to update it. But there's a policy question. Do we also update the next level of cache? So write through, the answer is yes. Write back, the answer is no. So we need to remember to update it later. Later, which is the which means a dirty bit. If we haven't decided we're storing a value in a cache, and there's a write to it, we have two choices. We have a policy question again. Do we store it anyways? And write allocate, the answer is yes. And write no allocate, the answer is no. Note that if we've read a value into the cache, we've decided we're storing it, we've already made that decision. Yes.
Is there ever going to be a scenario where something needs to be replaced in a cache and the dirty bit is set to zero?
So question, is there ever a time when something needs to be replaced in a cache and the dirty bit is zero? Yes, that happens very frequently. So an easy example is, let's say you only read. In that case, if you read more than fits in the cache, we're going to have replacements, but the dirty bit's going to be zero for them. Other questions? Yeah.
And so in that scenario, there wouldn't be a write to memory?
So question, in the scenario where we only read, there wouldn't be any writes? Yes, and these policies wouldn't matter. Because we're never having a situation where we have to handle a write to a value, or we have to have a value that we're writing that we haven't decided if we're storing. Yes?
So, could you have write no allocate with write through or write back then?
Question, can I have write no allocate with either write through or write back? Yes.
How does that work?
So if we decided we're storing the value, presumably because of a read, then our write through or write back apply. And if we haven't decided we're storing it, we don't store it anyways, which means it has to go to the next level. Because if we're not storing it, we still have to, I guess. So if we're not storing it, it better be sent to the next level, or else we'll forget about it. Yeah, because we can't forget about the value is the key thing, right? You have to do something with it. If you ever have a policy which is discard the value, that's bad. Yes. Question, when we say update the next level, do we update with the value we're storing in the initial? Yeah. Question, when we're storing something in the cache, do we always store the whole block? Yes. And that is the major cost to write allocate. So that we do need to have that whole block available. Okay, so then cache blocking. So I'll give the sort of high level description is that sort of we want to cache blocking, the idea is to work on groups of values that fit in our cache. So that's one view of it, is so that we're going to decide on some groups of values, typically values from matrices or arrays. So we're going to figure out a group that fits in our cache, and within a group, do as much as possible before moving on to the next group. Next group to take the most advantage of what fits in the cache. So that's our goal, is like we're going to figure out some set which fits in the cache, we're going to do all the work we can with that, and that's going to be better than sort of our naive approach. This improves on sort of choosing the right loop order, because we're not going to have any values where we have to, we're hopefully going to avoid having values with very poor spatial temporal locality. You know, e.g. in matrix multiply, you know, we're not going to load a value from a matrix and use it just once. You know, once before it gets evicted. You know, that's sort of what we're hoping to do with our design. We're going to be very far from using it just once. We're going to use it a lot and for all our values by how we choose that. And there's a bunch of compromises in that, which is typically why in practice people just try a bunch of sizes. But sort of our goal is that we're avoiding this kind of scenario where we just load a value once and use it only basically once or like a couple of times, and then it's going to get evicted because we're going to access a whole bunch of other stuff. And then quiz 10 are questions on temporal and spatial locality. Is this all of them? 6 through 9. Okay, yeah. So it was about so about this code, and it was about temporal and spatial locality for these, and so for temporal locality, we have, and it was asking about temporal locality in A and A, so let's look at A. So for here, So 0 plus, say, 1, and 1 plus 0 are the same thing. So that's potential temporal locality in both versions here. And so A is better in version 2 because we access, you know, sort of 0 plus 1 and 1 plus 0 and close, etc., you know, and similar pairs, and, you know, 1 plus 1 and 2 plus 0, 0 plus 2 and 2 plus 0, etc. In closer proximity because of this change to do this plus 16. So we have better temporal locality in A. I think temporal locality in B is better in version 2 because we repeatedly use the same J 16 times in a row versus not repeating the same J for 1024 iterations. So temporal locality is better, and so then spatial locality in C. So in version is better in version 1 because we always advance to an adjacent value, advance by J, which means to adjacent value addresses, indices, I should say, versus version 2, where we skip by 1024 because we advance by I. As far as the indices C, and then temporal locality in C, C is we never access the same index twice. twice, so the same. Same as both. Some questions about that locality figuring? Yes. So question, do we have locality even though we're only writing to A? Yes. So if we think of like a write back cache, that's going to matter. Does that answer your question? So that would be something we would care about performance wise is that, yeah, if we have like a write back cache, we want to be writing, not be, have to write of something from A. We hope to take advantage of that. But indeed, it matters less because it's writing. Like, it would matter a lot more if we were reading A. Okay, other questions? Yeah.
For temporal locality of A, the access doesn't have to be exactly one after the other, but rather closer in time.
Question, for temporal locality in A, the access doesn't have to be one after the other, but closer in time? Yes, because temporal locality is if we access something, we're going to access it again soon. And the sooner is better temporal locality. But in this case, there's a difference in how soon. Like, we have about 1,024 iterations later versus, like, about 16 iterations later.
So for spatial locality, would you, using the similar thoughts, say, accessing 0 seconds for to have some spatial
locality? Quick question. So for spatial locality, similarly, if we're skipping by a smaller amount, is that still better spatial locality? Yes, if it's, even if it's not by one. Okay, so then the OO architecture block diagram. So we have an in-order part, which is sort of fetch as usual, branch prediction, probably more complicated, usual, but multiple instructions at once, and branch prediction, but multiple instructions at once. So it's the same logic, it's just it's a lot more complicated because we have to like do a couple things at a time and deal with, oh, what if we predict the first instruction is a jump? Then register renaming, sort of, which is sort of pre-process instructions to identify potential conflicts. Then we have the out of order part. We have a queue, a sort of an unordered queue, or not, queue of instructions we could run, and we have execution units that are given instructions as inputs are available, and then we write back results. We have an in-order part, which is the commit, which handles, identifying what, registers are available for use again, for use, handling exceptions, etc., and other, and some other bookkeeping. And this is, I say, is in order because this takes, looks for the still does it in the program order. I guess also handling exceptions, handling part of handling branch mispredictions, squashing. So if we need to undo instructions, we have to know what order they came in. This is going to handle that logic for, oh, how do we figure out how to get back to a particular place we had a branch misprediction? Yes. Question, after we rename registers and we have instruction that refers to RAX, how do we remember which version of RAX that refers to? So in renaming, we're keeping track of what the current version of RAX is as we rename. If we need to look up that information later, so for example, if we have an exception and we need to go back to that version of RAX, this is what we didn't talk about in detail how this works, but this is what the commit stage is responsible for. There's several different strategies that are in common use. So one way is that we can have just a list of this instruction wrote this physical register, which is this architectural, which is RAX. And we can scan that table to find the actual version of RAX at the time of the exception. Does that answer your question? Okay, so exceptions. So exceptions generally are something happens that requires the OS to run because the processor doesn't know what to do about it itself. So this can include I/O, you know, like e.g. network input key press. This can include the program did something weird, like access memory through an invalid page table entry. Or could include a system call, a program requesting the OS's help. So the processor remembers where the program was, jumps to the OS, and in kernel mode. So the OS can do operations that only the OS should be allowed to do. Yes? Will you need to know the names of the types of exceptions? No, because as I mentioned, in practice, that's not consistent. I don't think it's worth memorizing those. You should know what things can cause an exception, but yeah, we aren't going to ask about the names that our book gives for those. Okay, and then quiz 14. Question 2 and 4. Okay, so question 2 is, we have 30-bit virtual addresses, 24-bit physical addresses, and 1,024-byte pages. So 1,024-byte pages is 2 to the 10-byte pages, which implies 10-bit page offsets. So our 30-bit virtual address has a 20-bit virtual page number and a 10-bit page offset. We could also divide up our physical address this way, but it doesn't help us in this question. And our page table is an array. It's an array of 4-byte page table entries. It's a single array. So this is a single level page table because it's just an array. And also because at this point in the class we haven't talked about multi-level page tables. Page table entries, and we need one for each virtual page number. And we have 2 to the 20 possible virtual page numbers. So the array is 2 to the 20 times 4 bytes, which is 2 to the 22 bytes, which you can compute for answering quick question. And then on question 3, was saying that we had a page table base register of 0x8800 and a VP virtual address of 0x12345. For those 96-byte pages and 4-byte page table entries. So we have to compute the address of the page table entry with a single level table. So this is the PHA base register plus our virtual address shifted over to remove the page offset, which is twelve bits, times our 4-byte PT size. And I think I'm just out of time, so I'll take questions here. Okay, yes. Question on the exam, can you leave things as arithmetic expressions? Humans will be grading the exam, so within reason, yes. Like as long as the expressions aren't like, extract the page offset of this, you know, or something like that. Like, we expect you to just show that you know what the work needs to be done. Yeah. Question is, will we give partial credit for work? Sometimes. Generally, I would like to see something written on the line for the answer that is related to the answer. And we're not going to, look for work actively on the page. Does that answer your question?